Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. We cram a lot into our lives. For those of us working full-time, how do you find the time to not only perform on the job, but eat right, get enough exercise, and take care of our families, too? No one has a simple solution, but that's why sometimes making small tweaks can put us on the path to healthier habits, as opposed to further ingraining ones that might make us feel good, and maybe guilty, too, but aren't so healthy. Things like avoiding exercise, eating processed food, or sugar-filled candy. My guest today, Dr. Monique Tello, has written a new book that aims to help us make small movements in the right and healthier direction. It's called Healthy Habits for Your Heart, 100 Simple, Effective Ways to Lower Your Blood Pressure and Maintain Your Heart's Health. Tello is a primary care doctor, teacher, researcher, writer, and mother who works in Boston, Massachusetts. Her personal blog, Part Medicine, Part Reflection, Part Recipes, All Lifestyle, is at her self-titled site, Dr. Monique Tello, TELLO.com. But she also blogs for the widely read Harvard Health blog, from which she developed the new book, which contains not only health tips, but strategies for achieving them, in addition to recipes. It's published by Adams Media. Dr. Monique Tello, author of Healthy Habits for Your Heart, is our guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Monique Tello, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you tell us what was the inspiration for your book, Healthy Habits for Your Heart.
So I have been blogging for Harvard Health Blog for a little while now, and as the years have gone by, I've been more and more drawn to lifestyle medicine. This is also like sort of a hot topic. It's a growing area of interest, particularly for primary care doctors, as we're all realizing what the research has been showing us since like the 1970s, that diet, like what we eat, and activity and our psychological state, stress management, really are sort of the foundation, the base for most of our health. And actually, when we're not doing those things right, it's the cause of most health problems, you know, the big ones, obesity, hypertension, high cholesterol, diabetes, heart disease, strokes, everything. The whole gamut, everything that we see in everyday practice can be prevented or cured through lifestyle medicine. And I started learning more and more about the research as Harvard Health Blog was asking me to cover these studies. A study would come out saying Harvard researchers have done a study showing that these lifestyle factors are particularly associated with a longer life. You know, and I would read the study and be like, wow, just eating a plant-based diet can give you 2 years of extra life over people that don't have a plant-based diet. And if you throw in not smoking and being active 120 minutes a week, it's even more, you know, it's just, you get so excited about this stuff. And I realized, wow, we're actually in the way primary care is set up right now. It's very much sick care. We're not really helping people to live healthier. We're just sort of taking care of people when they get sick, as a lot of people are realizing that medicine, Western medicine, is sort of operating that way. And it's probably not the way we should be going. So I got more and more interested in this and trying to figure out how we can help people to make these changes at the primary care level. So the cardiologist is going to see my patients when they have heart disease, like when they have problems. They don't want to see my patients beforehand, really. So what I wanted to do was write a book that would be a guide helping my patients at sort of the primary care level understand why we care about heart disease, why you want to prevent it, just to sort of understand what we mean by that, like in just general terms and real English, and then to go into the behavioral nitty-gritty day-to-day changes that we can make in order to achieve a healthier lifestyle. That's sort of a long answer to your question.
No, that's okay. Well, so that's one of the things I really liked about the book is that you write from the perspective of a primary care physician, which you are, and it's not sort of from on high a cardiologist. And so it felt very accessible to me. Now I'm kindred spirits because that's what I practice is primary care. But I agree with you. It's hard to engage in some of these healthy lifestyle habits when it seems like you're constantly being challenged to put out fires and things. So I'm curious, you mentioned lifestyle medicine, and I think for many of our listeners, there may be connotations of lifestyle medicine going to spas and doing yoga or massage like that. But what I think, does lifestyle medicine have a more technical definition? You mentioned it's sort of in vogue right now, and you talked about some of the conditions that it can treat. How would you define lifestyle medicine or the lifestyle medicine you practice?
Absolutely. So yeah, when you think of lifestyle medicine, you think lifestyles of the rich and famous. Like it doesn't immediately bring to mind nutrition, physical activity, stress management, sleep, socializing. Like, it's the things that make up our day-to-day life, and that's lifestyle medicine. You got to eat. You got to move. You got to interact with other people. You got to manage your stress. And so it all boils down to these root causes of illness and the ways to prevent illness. We know very well, there's been research going back to the 70s and 80s. I think about Dean Ornish. You're familiar with Dean Ornish and his many, many books on this, showing that heart disease could actually be reversed through a strict plant-based diet, exercise, and this was really important, he also added in these psychological supports. They did behavioral counseling. They did family-style meals with patients. They did social connection. They connected people in groups. And their heart disease, this was before statins were like invented. And they were able to actually demonstrate with like cardiac cath that these coronary arteries that were clogged before the people got engaged with the study and went through the whatever it was, it was like a 12-month intensive program, those clogged arteries cleared out. And we know this has been replicated now so many times, and we know that the way we eat, the way we move, the way we interact with other people, the way we manage our stress can have a huge impact on our health.
So one of the reasons that I like the book is it's short, for one thing, and it's written in a way such that it's broken down into 100 simple, effective ways to lower your blood pressure and maintain your heart's health. So it sounds fairly prescriptive when you have a list of 100 things. But part one is really one of the nicest, most straightforward explanations of cardiac physiology I've ever seen, which, I mean, may sound daunting, but you explain it in a very readable, very brief way that just kind of shows how the circuit of the heart works and what clogged arteries actually look like. And then you go into the habits for heart health, which is really the main part of the book. But I noticed something interesting, which is you talk about nutrition and the importance of a plant-based diet and then about exercise, which is vitally important. But actually the first part of your recommendations are all what you call foundational habits, and they have really nothing to do with diet or exercise. They're really much more about how you get through a day, how you cope, how you and just by way of example, you have recommendations here like cuddle with your kitten or have a cup of tea. Protect yourself from stressful people. Now, these are, they're not revolutionary ideas at all, but you're suggesting that based on medical science that these things actually improve your heart health. Can you comment on how you found these things?
Absolutely. So definitely a big part of the book, the idea behind it, was to convince people in the very beginning that behavioral approaches and behavioral changes were really the underlying most important part. Like, people tell me this all the time. I know what to eat. I know what to do, but I can't seem to make it happen. Why not? And that's that can't seem to make it happen that I wanted to address first. So how do we make behavioral changes before we can change our diet, before we can incorporate exercise into our days? We first need to figure out self-care. How am I going to prioritize self-care? How am I going to manage stress? How am I going to protect myself from toxic people that make me feel bad? These core, very, very important behavioral aspects or psychological aspects, stress management, sleep, these things needed to come first. And so a large part of the book is sort of convincing people that really do need to focus on behavior.
One of the other facets of the book that I really like is that not only do you have sort of the numbered recommendation for a healthy habit, but then you have tips to make the habit stick. So it's almost like you can hear the reader saying, well, I can't really nurture my best relationships because blank, or I can't really, you know, go for a walk outside today because, you know, I have too much to do with work or something like that. And so you have these just these nice kind of friendly tips to suggest, first of all, that you don't have to make all of the change at once, and secondly, that you can make small tweaks to things to kind of get moving at least in the right direction.
Yeah, and every single one of the tips is based on some research, some science that shows that this will help, this can help to prevent heart disease. I really wanted to make sure that this was evidence-based and didn't have anything weird or faddish. You know, I wanted to make sure everything was solid and safe and effective. And part of that is also making it accessible to people. So you can say, oh, you should aim for 10 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. If you just leave it at that, people are going to be like, what? How am I going to do that? But a big part of this was saying, you know what? Even if you only can fit in two and a half servings of fruits and vegetables per day, there's still a benefit there. You can start with a small change, and sort of suggesting very small, doable things makes it a little bit more accessible.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Monique Tello, who's a primary care doctor at Massachusetts General Hospital. She's also a teacher, a researcher, a writer. She has her own blog at drmoniquetello.com, but is also a frequent contributor to Harvard Health Blog. And Dr. Monique Tello, you have been writing for Harvard Health Blog for how long now and contributing?
About 5 years.
And you were mentioning to me, and I look at the Harvard Health Blog from time to time, but it has a huge readership.
Yeah, they have an amazingly big reach, 2 million Twitter followers right now. I don't know how many subscribers. And it was the blogging that I was doing on Harvard Health Blog, which was largely diet and lifestyle, you know, nutrition science, and sort of delving into the research and explaining it for the public, that caught the eye of an acquisitions editor at Simons & Schuster. They were looking for an author for a book that they had already pitched to the higher-ups there, and they knew what they wanted. They knew what book they wanted, or generally, like, what book they wanted. They had done their market research. They knew that there was probably a place for a heart health book that was very behaviorally focused, and they loved the habits idea. And so they literally cold called me. They just emailed me, and they're like, we're editors at Adams Media, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster, and we're wondering if you might be interested in authoring a book for us. And I was like, are you kidding me? Is this a joke? Like, I would love to. And that's how the book came about. But they knew they wanted something lifestyle medicine, behavioral-based, focusing on habits. And I was already coming to the realization that that's really the way to go. That's the best way to help people achieve a healthy lifestyle. You've got to focus on helping them change their behavior, and you've got to focus on changing their habits.
And it sounds like, too, you mentioned wanting to make it evidence-based, and it sounds like the publishers or the editors at first didn't really want to include your references to the medical literature. And I should point out there's a very robust, very small print, but very readable set of references to the papers and, I guess, book chapters that you cite in each of your chapters, so that if people want to go to the primary medical literature, they're able to do that. But it sounds like you won that battle.
Yeah, they asked me not once, not twice, actually several times, if we could move the references section to my blog. They said, that's a thing. People do that. You can't fit all the references in the book. We could just make a little note that if people are interested, they can go look at your blog for the references. And I said, no. The whole point of the book is that it's evidence-based. This has got to be based in actual science. People have to know that we're not just making stuff up. The internet is full of made-up stuff. You know, there's no end to that. They've got to know that what we're suggesting is actually backed up by research. It was really important to me, and I did sort of take a bit of a hard stand on that and offered to cut out, if we were over, you know, word count, I offered to cut out other sections. In the end, they actually, my understanding was they increased the word count. It was supposed to be 50,000, and they went up to 60,000 to accommodate the references section.
Wow. Well, it's I like the idea for the sake of the reader that you made it self-contained, and you don't have to, you know, get a copy of the book and then be sitting next to a computer or use your phone to go look for the references. Now, I want to talk a little bit about that, about phones, because this is clearly one of the lifestyle things that many of us use, smartphones, and abuse, probably spend way too much time on them. And so you have a couple of tips in here about how to manage your phone use and limit the amount of time. Is that something you kind of remember off the top of your head and could share?
Yeah, so I've got some tips at the end related to all kinds of things that people can get addicted to, basically, and that's very much a part of behavior change. I guess to go back a little bit about why I wanted to talk about technology and technology addiction, as well as I talk a little bit about food, overeating, and stress eating, and then even forms of food addiction, and alcohol, and smoking, and all of these things. That's sort of the last chapter, but it's because I want to highlight, for many people, their unhealthy habits are because they are self-medicating for some kind of untreated, unrecognized underlying psychological issue. And I put it at the end because it's kind of a hard sell for a lot of people. But it makes sense. I mean, people turn to substances and activities to numb them, to make them feel better. And smartphones and video games and television, people do, and I think it's people joke about the fact that they're addicted to their smartphones and things like that, their kids addicted to video games, but it's actually a thing. You know, the brain, you can get sort of like numbed or entertained or distracted from emotional pain or distress by burying yourself in the phone, in the video games, binge watching, you know, whatever Netflix show is hot. And all of those things are kind of not very healthy. So it's really hard to make a big lifestyle change if you're playing video games 6 hours a day, for example. So just pointing out that technology can sometimes really pull people in. People get very dependent on their technology, and sometimes we have to take a look at that and think about how we can step away. And that last chapter, that chapter 8, talks a little bit about stress eating and how to manage that, and smoking and how to manage that, technology and how to manage that, with alcohol and binge eating and sort of other severe diagnoses, depression, anxiety. I don't really give tips. I tell people, you know what, for these issues, you probably should seek professional help because these may obstruct your goals to live healthy. Like, these sort of have to be dealt with first before probably you're going to be successful in changing your daily habits.
Now, I notice in that chapter 8, you also have available these questionnaires. There's something called a PHQ-9, which is a really validated tool, but quick and dirty for assessing someone for depression, just using a scoring system. And then there's the GAD-7, Generalized Anxiety Disorder Questionnaire. So depression and anxiety are the two most common afflictions in the general population, and something that many of us suffer from, sometimes one, sometimes the other, sometimes both. Mm-hmm. And so this gives the reader an opportunity to kind of assess yourself in a non-medical setting just by reading the book. And then I should also point out that you even are good enough to include recipes in this, what amounts to a very tiny book. There's some really delicious-looking, heart-healthy recipes that, this is not comprehensive in any way in terms of the recipes, but on your blog, I noticed that, you know, in addition to talking about medical ideas, and this is always really with an eye toward the lay reader because you write with a, you know, general internal medicine or primary care physician's viewpoint, it seems like every third blog post, maybe every fourth, is something you cooked. And there are these gorgeous pictures of these mostly plant-based recipes that it seems like you tinker with or make. And I like the blog a lot because it not only did it have sort of the medical stuff that kind of fed my brain, but then it also talks about, you know, your own struggles as being someone who's working and as a parent of two young kids and trying to balance it all. It's not easy to do these things.
No, it's not. And you know, I don't want anyone to think that I have it totally together. You know, we definitely, like, for example, you've noticed some of the recipes are not healthy. So I try to get the kids in the kitchen, and they're not going to come in the kitchen and make like broccoli with me. So I'll get them in the kitchen, and we'll make cookies or pancakes. And that's okay. Like, we don't have to be eating, you know, a perfectly plant-based, low saturated fat, no processed carbs diet all the time. And that's a big message in the book as well. You know, you aim for the best you can do. You aim for most of the time. With kids, sometimes to instill a love of cooking or an interest even in food preparation, sometimes you got to cook fun stuff. And so I had a post just, I think it was last week or the week before, we made glass out of sugar, and it was so much fun. It was really pure sugar. We melted sugar and made glass out of it, and did fun stuff with it. Like, we made sea glass. It looks just like sea glass, but it's sugar. And the kids loved it. It got them in the kitchen. It got them learning. It was good.
Dr. Tello, I wanted to ask you, I gather that you are a runner or were a runner at one point? Are you?
Yeah, I love to run. I haven't run a marathon, though, since 2001. I ran a few back in those days. You know, it's hard. And I get it. When I have patients who are parents and they talk about how their diet and lifestyle just went all to heck when they had kids, I totally get it. I've struggled with this. So a big part of what I try to get across in the book and with my patients is that every little bit counts. It took me a while to realize this. I actually gained a ton of weight in my pregnancies. But it took me 2 years to lose the 50 extra pounds I put on after my daughter was born. I was in obesity range. I was literally BMI 30 and was hanging out there for a while. This was not just like while I was pregnant. This was actually well afterwards when I had no business being BMI 30. And it took me 2 years of experimenting and trying different things, different dietary approaches, and just figuring out that fitting in activity wherever you can, even if it's, and literally this is how I started, just doing some girly push-ups and some crunches on the floor in my daughter's bedroom after the kids were asleep, and that was all I could manage, but it was something. And so that's how that started, and it took me 2 years. I lost 50 pounds, and a lot of the habits that I developed during that time that I experimented with and figured out worked for me are in this book. So the book mentions, for example, closing down the kitchen after 8 o'clock. So you're done eating, because nighttime eating is particularly associated with weight gain and overweight and obesity. Making those rules for yourself that you decide you're going to follow. I'm not a person that eats after 8 p.m., that kind of thing. Those are things I do and work for some people.
Now, back to the running, because habit number 79, run for your life. This surprised me for 5 minutes a day.
Yeah.
So there was a 2014 study of 15 years worth of data, 55,000 people that said running for as little as 5 to 10 minutes a day was associated with a 45% reduced risk of death from heart attack and stroke. 5 to 10 minutes. So
yeah.
Your point is just some is better than none.
Absolutely. And that's a big psychological barrier, the all or none thinking. People say, oh, I don't have time to go to spinning class 3 days a week, so therefore I'm not exercising at all. I'm like, wait a minute, let's dial it back here. Let's think about what we can do. And we try to just break it down. Very small bursts of activity just spread throughout the day, actually probably even more effective for fitness and for weight loss.
And there's something, too, that I've long heard at various hospitals that I've worked at or workplaces where they say, oh, if you're going to go only one flight or up one floor in a building, you know, don't take the elevator for one floor. So you can at least walk up one or down two. Don't be lazy, but also don't waste the electricity, that type of a thing. Now, it wasn't in the book, I don't think, although you do say make your day harder, which I've heard before, like park, don't always try to get the closest.
Yeah.
Inconvenience yourself. Now, is it true? Because I guess people have read your blog and then quizzed you on this, but do you walk many flights of stairs at Massachusetts General Hospital or where the building you work in?
I do, and this is a running joke with my students who we go rounding on the floors. So I got stuck in one of these elevators once. It was many years ago. It was over 10 years ago. I was pregnant, and one of the elevators in the tallest tower that we have at the hospital got stuck, and I was stuck in there for a couple of hours. And it was just horrible. It was not fun. And I decided after that, you know what? I'm going to try to just take the stairs all the time. And I just developed that habit. I became a person who does not take the elevator. And it's really stuck with me to the point where when it comes to stair climbing, at first it was brutal. I was not in great stair climbing shape. But at this point, I have no problem walking up 22 flights of stairs to see a patient. And I will. I will not get in that elevator.
Wow. But I mean, born of the trauma of being stuck there.
I know. And now it's not like I'm terrified to get. I will, if I have to get in an elevator, I'll get in an elevator. But I really prefer not to. I actually really like taking the stairs. I've noticed that I have gained fitness simply from taking the stairs whenever I can.
Now, how do the students respond to this? Are they, you're saying it's a running joke, so they know you're sort of the doctor who likes to walk the stairs.
Yes. So it's divided in two camps. I'll have the students who are like, I can do this. I'm game to do this. And they're all young, healthy, strapping kids, right? But about half of them are like, you know what? I'm going to take the elevator up to the fifth floor. And I'm like, fine, you're not going to get graded differently. You're not going to take the stairs with me. But, you know, I do hope to instill this habit in people, because we really, if we're healthy, if we're able to, what a blessing. What a blessing for us that we can take the stairs. Why not? Let's do it. Save the electricity, save the elevator for the people in wheelchairs or who can't. There's a lot of people who can't do it for many, many health reasons.
Now, part of your professional career, you're engaged in research. And offline, you were telling me about an interesting study that you're gearing up to participate in with a physician who's also a chef.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about this research protocol that you're part of?
Yeah, and I'm so fascinated that you and your wife know Ronnie Polak. He is a MD, an MBA, and a chef, a formally trained chef. He's the director of the chef coaching program here at there's a Center for Lifestyle Medicine here, and he teaches people how to cook with a web-based teaching program that's been very successful. And so he came up with this study idea, and he's really the leader behind this, but he needed people to help with the recruitment of patients. His idea is that we can recruit patients who have certain diet and nutrition-related health problems like obesity, hypertension, diabetes, things like this, recruit them into the study where they literally get to participate in the chef coaching program, like for free, and see what happens. And so there's going to be specific outcome measures, like lab values and blood pressure measurements and weight and things like that, that we're going to be looking at in the end, after the end of the study period, which I believe is like a year, and see if it makes a difference. See if teaching people how to cook, how to prep food, how to shop for food helps. I think we're hypothesizing that it will, because other research seems to suggest that that's the case.
So the intervention group are the people recruited to participate in these online cooking classes or demonstrations, right? And then is there a control group, which is just standard of care, meaning like
yeah.
no, or just maybe instructions at a doctor visit, but no, nothing else?
Yeah, there's going to be some probably, if I recall correctly, it's going to be the second thing that you said. So some kind of written instruction or pamphlet or something like that.
Well, I just wanted to conclude by asking you how your best wisdom on how you manage to balance this all. You're now the author of a successful book. You're a practicing physician. You're a teacher, researcher, and importantly, a mom. And you said you don't have all the answers, but I guess how have you managed to put it all together in these last couple of years at least?
Ha! Hey, you know, my life is hectic. I do feel very strongly about prioritizing self-care. You know, there's things that I let go because it's so important for me to be able to get in some kind of physical activity, even if it's just getting off the T, the train line here, the subway, a stop early and walking to the hospital or taking the stairs to see patients. You know, it's so important to me to do family time, sit-down family dinner most nights, not all the time. We're not perfect about it. Doing family activities with the kids, we try really hard not to overschedule them. They don't do as many activities as other kids. Things like that. You know, we really try to prioritize the foundational habits that I talk about in my book. It's sort of like how we try to live. Are we perfect? No, but that's the point I try to get across, not only in the book and to my patients, but just in real life. You do the best you can. You take care of yourself. You take care of the people around you.
Yeah, and that really comes across is sort of taking care of yourself first before you delve into these things that might be more challenging, like eating right or exercising, which is such a challenge for so many of us.
Yeah, the prioritizing self-care, especially for caregivers and not just healthcare providers, also mothers and fathers, it's such a difficult concept sometimes. But I, the analogy of the flight attendant giving those instructions on the airplane, you know, if the oxygen masks come down, you need to put it on yourself first before you help the people around you. So a patient of mine pointed out that's so counterintuitive. I mean, as a mom, don't you want to put the oxygen mask on your kid first? And I said, well, yeah, meantime, if you fall unconscious and die from lack of oxygen, what good are you for your kid, you know? And she's like, oh, that's the point. You know, you have to be able to, you can't take care of others until you take care of yourself. You have to be your best self in order to do your best work for other people.
Well, the name of the book is Healthy Habits for Your Heart, 100 Simple, Effective Ways to Lower Your Blood Pressure and Maintain Your Heart's Health. And it's by my guest today, Dr. Monique Tello. Dr. Tello, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.